Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2011.
Today, review of accounting. Now, I do a review of accounting with some decision-making calculus. I can either set my face on fire and beat it out with a frying pan, or I can do a review of accounting. It's an iffy decision for me. I am not an accountant. I have taught accounting, and I've pretended to be an accountant, but I'm not an accountant. And I do want to encourage you to know a few basics before I get started with the review. This is the backstory of accounting in finance. And I do apologize. Do I have any accounting majors in here? Yeah. So don't take this the wrong way. Okay, take it the wrong way, because that's the way I mean it. No. I will not tell any accounting jokes. I will not. Okay, one. No. Here's the deal. In the real world, the RW as we call it, we have a little bit of an ongoing battle between finance and accounting. Accountants are selling themselves as the experts in finance. As a matter of fact, if you look in many of the leading journals that hire people out of college, hire people who have experience in business, and they want financial analysts, they will put on their accounting degree required because they are under the false impression that accounting covers finance. In fact, they are not related very much at all. And part of the problem is the fault of finance, because we constantly teach you accounting, review of accounting, accounting principles. Let's look at the accounting the financial statements that were prepared by accountants. In that way, we feed that idea that accounting is going to provide all of your information. Accountants are absolutely crucial to the business world. In fact, we would not have a business world as we know it today if it had not been for accounting. I brought up in an early lecture that once a double ledger accounting system had been developed by a monk named Pacioli, it was used by businesses to then be able to represent to money people, lenders like the Medici's and those groups, here's what we are financially. And that was how there was more developed a confidence, or at least some system of review, whereby the wealthy, the powerful, could provide money to investment to entrepreneurs. Even beyond that, though, as this money was beginning to flow in a more capitalist way rather than in a more medieval way, that money began to flow in other directions. Investments became more comfortable for the wealthy. Those investments included not just business investments, but investments in the arts, in paintings, in sculpture. Those fancy classical pieces of music that you have heard of that were, oh, obviously this is the peak and pinnacle of all musical creations, bullshit. It was the stuff that the money people were paying for. That's what made it famous. That's what made it the standard. So you see that accounting system flows out into investments and into explorations of new worlds. If they began then as there was more money and more comfort with doing investments, it was invested in arts, it was invested in the sciences. Some of the great scientists were at the hog trough of the rich, and they expected to have an accounting of what they had put into the sciences in many cases. So accounting is crucial. It is not, however, finance. As a matter of fact, I brought this up. Can you remember what is one of the most important differences between accounting data and financial data? That's okay. Understand this. Yeah, you want?
Is it like more objective?
The accounting data is very objective. It's subjective, yeah. Yeah, we're very subjective. Matter of fact, if we're not subjective enough, we get drunk, and then we're really subjective. Now, go ahead. Opportunity cost. That was one of them I brought up. It is not in an accounting statement. Opportunity cost, the cost of the best foregone alternative. That will probably be the driving cost of any investment decision. It's not in the accounting data, not represented. It can't be because it is a speculative. It is not money in, it is not money out of the pocket. It is money that did not come into the pocket because of the choice you made. Every choice you make carries with it a cost. Nothing is free. Nothing. And I don't care to hear you say love is free. No, love is not free. I was in the Army. It was $25. $35 if you didn't want ugly. I saved the $10 for Denny's. No, seriously, noobs. Save the money. Denny's has grand slams. Okay. Unlike the girls I used to date. Here you go. And there's another thing, too. In finance, we care about the future. I don't give, honestly, and forgive me for my French, I don't give a rat's ass. Oh, that's right, it's French. Rat's ass for the past. I need to know what's going to happen tomorrow because that's where my cash flow is going to happen, is in the tomorrow. So you tell me about the past, that's wonderful. And if you can convince me that there is something about the past that's still speaking about what's going to happen, that's even better. And that's why when I do financial analysis, this classic look at the accounting statements, do the ratios, all that kind of stuff, you see me focusing more on patterns of change from one period to the next, 1 year to the next in the accounting information. That tells me about, if I see, for example, the current ratio going down and down and down year over year, that tells me something about the future. It also tells me something about a change in the psychology of management. They're obviously leaning out their current cash flow. On the other hand, if I see a company that on first blush looks like it has no debt in its capital structure, well, that's a wonderful thing. But then I ask the next question, why the hell not? It's wonderful to be an all-equity company until you realize that the cost of equity is staggering compared to the cost of debt, at least for those first rounds of tranches of debt that the company takes on. So I have to ask the questions behind it, patterns, motivations, reasons. That's what I teach you. Financial analysis in its standard form, what I was, for a 240 class, I can just say, well, here's your damn ratio table, figure this out, calculate this, and there's your grade. I want you to think a little bit beyond those. What does it mean when I have a times interest earned that is 9.0 in an industry that has a times interest earned of 4.2? What does it mean when I have a net income of 0.1%? Is that a horrible thing? I have no idea because I have to look at that in relation to the industry. There are some companies that have net to sales that is just absolutely outstanding, 20%, 25%. Then I see a company that has net income to sales that is 1%, 0.5%. Does that mean that that company is on the verge of bankruptcy? No, it just means that I need to look at the industry. And also, even if they're outside of the industry norm, that isn't the end of the story. I might want to look at their financial information, see if I can read some tea leaves. Here we go. The first thing, resources that are useful to you, and I'm giving you a broad background in this first round, and then on Wednesday we tack it down, and I actually give you some work to do in the class to turn in so I can run around the room the way I do sometimes and just watch you to make sure you do it right. It's the best way to ensure that you're not going to make a mistake that's going to flow onto an exam, is if I'm working around the room watching you do the work. So that'll be on Wednesday. But for now, let's go get a couple of first rounds out of the way. Accounting information is where we start. We have to. It's the basis. Because we know it's reliable under generally accepted accounting principles and standards, we know that we are dealing with information that is consistent from company to company. That does not mean that companies can't play a lot of games with their financial statements. So we always have to keep that in the back of our mind. You take me for a higher powered course, and I will show you how it's done and how you can get behind the curtain to see what's going on. But for here, we'll just take the accounting information as it comes to us. Now, as far as accounting information goes, for public companies, which is what we focus on in most courses, for public companies, the first place you go for financial information is not to the company, not to Bloomberg, not to this, not to that. You go to the SEC. The SEC has, in the modern world, an ancient filing system called EDGAR. I used to be an EDGAR filing agent. Companies would prepare their financial information and a lot of other information, and they would then submit it electronically with tags that were like HTML tags, except it was SGML, Standard Generalized Markup Language. And those tags would be read by the computers at the SEC, and it would be put into readable form. This EDGAR system bought from the SEC is available to you straight on. It's available to all people. And here, with your student accounts, you can get access to it through the Milner Library if you want to do it that way. All public companies have to make filings with the SEC. All public companies have to make filings with SEC. Now, here I'm going to take you down a brief route. I want you to remember this. And also, I used to do this. This was one of my main work as a consultant, was just the paperwork and the electronic filings and writing these things up. I can't do it anymore because, well, never mind. Okay. Let's start with a company that decides to go public. A company decides it is going to go public. In other words, it is going to sell stock to outside investors, and absent a lot of exemptions, they are going to have to go through a full-blown registration process. And I went through some, and I did all the registration statements. The biggest of the big are the S-1. You file for a public offering on Form S-1. It is the big kahuna, raising hundreds of millions of dollars, possibly even billions. This is a notification to the Securities and Exchange Commission that you have an intent to sell stock in the corporation. Taking it from there, we file Form S-1, which comprises three parts. One of the parts is the financial information, the financial statements. They must be audited by a reputable accounting firm and all of that kind of stuff. Under Sarbanes-Oxley, which was passed more than a few years ago by Congress pretending that it actually cared about the financial scandals, Sarbanes-Oxley, otherwise known as the Accountants and Lawyers Employment Assurance Act. They'll audit the financial statements part of it. The financial statements are part of the prospectus. That's the thing that is handed out to people as a solicitation for offers to sell the stock. That is an offer to sell the stock. There are other parts to this, too. This Form S-1 is a monster. I did only one S1 in my time. The first time I submitted it, came back with the SEC, their corporate division, reviews it, came back with an ungodly number of deficiencies. I thought I was going to vomit. My fax machine just kept pouring. I called an old consultant, and I said, you know, I'm out of this business. And he said, no, that was actually pretty good. 430-some, no, that's not bad. Filed it three more times, and then it was qualified. Understand this. The SEC does not approve an offering. It qualifies an offering. There is nothing the SEC approves of. They merely qualify an offering once it has met the minimum standards of compliance with the Securities Act of 1933, which is the relevant act for these public offerings. The Securities Act of 1933 governs Form S-1 and all of the others. By the way, other offerings, there's an SB-1, small business offering. There's an SB2. There are other ones along here, too. I'm focusing on the big monster. Once they qualify, the company sells its stock, and you hope that it all works out. And I'll get into this in a little more detail in a future lecture. But for the purposes of this lecture, essentially what you are doing is you are establishing a permanent communication with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Understand this, the financial information and other information of a corporation is prepared for information consumers. And there are different constituencies of those consumers. There's a constituency of regulators, there's a constituency of existing shareholders, there's a constituency of potential shareholders, and then you have other constituencies, special interest groups, political, social. There are constituency groups that comprise members of the workers' unions. There are constituencies that comprise, well, I wouldn't get into that, but know this. There are all these different people that are interested in what's going to happen with this corporation. From here, essentially, the company has filed the equivalent of a Form 10. So if you already have stock and you want to make it public, you could file a Form 10 instead of a Form S1. You could do either. If you are selling new stock, it would be an S1. But if you already have stock out there and you want to make it freely tradable, you want to become a public company, you could file Form 10. Either way, you are then in the gun sights of the Securities and Exchange Commission. They're going to watch your ass forever. You have got to make your filings on time. And you can never, ever lie. Because if you lie, they will hunt you down and they will beat you with a rake like a dog. Form 10 or S1, and like I said, there are SB1s, SB2s, there are a lot of different ones. But once you have filed this, you then have to file periodic reports. Annually, you will be filing Form 10K, which contains audited financial statements. Quarterly, you will be filing Form 10Q. So we call these the Qs and Ks. And you'll hear me say that in this class. You need to look at the Qs and Ks of such and such a company. Matter of fact, my own business 100 students, those early freshmen, the newbies that you like to trip when they're walking across campus, I have them learn how to find Qs and Ks right off the bat. Because these are from the company to the Securities and Exchange Commission, intended for information consumers, not just at the SEC, but in the investment community. Because you know what? I don't care what these magazines and talk shows and Jim Cramers and all these other idiots say. I want to see what the company has said to the SEC. Because it's the SEC that can make, if the company lies and gets burned, it's the SEC and referencing to the Department of Justice that can make the executives of that company hard-timers old ladies. So that's where I go for my information. And that's one of the things that I want to make sure you know in here. You don't have to buy investment services. You don't have to listen to idiots on television. You go to the watering source and you read the information yourself. And I'm going to tell you a couple of things about it. Now, the Form 10K, the 10Qs give the quarterly stuff, quarterly financials. There's also another form that is important for you to keep your eye on. And these are actually, as a consultant, I made a decent kind of stream of money off this one. These were just a bear to do, and I couldn't really charge what the opportunity cost of my time was, but I did make up for it with the 8Ks, Form 8K. These are a weird little animal. Now, if you look in a company on Edgar, you're going to see all kinds of different forms of different kinds. Focus on the Ks and Qs and look for 8Ks. 8Ks are notices of non-recurring events. Every company that's a public company must give a notice to the SEC about things that have happened. Now, in a lot of cases, this is trivial stuff. I had to file Form 8K every time one of my client companies did a press release. I mean, some of my companies were putting out press releases every week trying to pump their stocks so the owners could dump it. But the 8Ks also can give you some cool stuff, something about one of the directors passed on. Oh, well, let's look into that. What kind of a director was this? Was this one of these directors in name only, or was this a director who had very clear influence, or was this a director who was a power broker behind the scenes in the company? 8Ks can tell you interesting things, interesting stories. Numbers aren't always the only thing you can look at when you are in investment analysis or in other fields of finance. Have a look at the 8Ks. You'll find out that usually they're pretty bland. Oh, geez, it's just another press release. Or, oh, geez, one of the CEO of the company farted or something like that. But honestly, every once in a while, you can get a darn good nugget out of an 8K. Also, make sure that you look for, on the Ks and Qs, look for the slash As. Those are amendments where they've screwed something up and they go back and they fix it by amendment. Sometimes because they got caught, sometimes it's just something trivial, sometimes it is something that if you just looked at the K, you would be looking at data that they had updated after they filed it. There were a couple of cases, in fact, where I did amendments just because, I mean, they got me the information like 2 weeks before the filing deadline. You put together what you can as fast as you can, and then you do an amendment later. Back in my day, we could do that. Back now, that's not such a good idea to do, as far from what I've heard. But, you know, there you go. Sometimes we just slap together crap and then get it on. Here's the deal. Getting back to accounting and financial analysis and accounting, that's your core resource for getting your financial data. Your income, your revenue, your costs of different kinds, your liabilities, your current assets, your long-term assets, all of that kind of stuff. That's where you get it from, is those financials. And I always recommend, don't become dependent upon the pretty fluffy stuff that's published by Yahoo Finance. I mean, first of all, if you are really investing based upon information from something called Yahoo, worry. But just get your data from the source. Learn how to be one of the people who goes to the source instead of one of the dependents that goes on TV to hear what the analyst said it was because they're too afraid, I can't do math. Go to the horse's mouth. But then, here's the deal. The financial statements themselves, you have couple of different ones here. You've got your income statement. Which is actually, and this accounting, the accounting teachers just hate it when I say this. The income statement is actually just a giant nodule on the balance sheet. It's just an expanded piece of the balance sheet. The balance sheet. And then another giant nodule that's sometimes mentioned, sometimes not, is the statement of retained earnings. And again, this is actually just a manifestation of a little piece on the balance sheet, just like the income statement is. They're really prepared as parts of the balance sheet. And then you have one that's pretty important to us in finance. It's rather crucial in your statement of cash flows. Because in the statement of cash flows, they back out of some of the accounting stuff that's not real money. And they put it back in to show what the actual cash money that's happening is. And in finance, we care about cash. We care about money. Because you could have a company that on its financial statements had a really nice net income, but if they don't have the cash to pay their bills, they're done. Game over, you see. But then there's one here in this whole thing. These are the ones that you've all had accounting. Is that correct? I assume. Okay. You still seem like pretty nice people. Okay. But there's one here. Is there one that I've forgotten here? And I'll bet you I'll be shocked if there's someone who says it. But it's actually very important to financial analysts. Anyone see one that I didn't put in there? You're going to say, well, duh, I thought that was another part of another one. Actually, it encompasses these. It would address all of them. It's unlike the income statement and the statement of retained earnings, which are just parts of the balance sheet, and the statement of cash flows, which is just a rectification of the parts of the balance sheet to make it so that we're talking about real cash flows. The one that at the end that I haven't brought up yet addresses all of these. What is it?
Oh. Huh? Owner's equity.
Well, that's part of the balance sheet. Here it is. The footnotes to the financial statement. You know what? A good writer of footnotes is a thing of beauty. Because in those footnotes, I can tell stories about why the numbers are the way they are in the other parts of the financial statements. I can put in there the details of compensations. I can put in there the details of reserves for future contingencies. In there, I can mention, oh, by the way, we're about to go under, suckers. It can be that serious. In some of the companies that I was dealing with, there was something that you put as the last statement in the financial statements. It said that these financial statements have been prepared under the assumption that this firm is a going concern. The fact that it is probably not a going concern means that what you have seen before is irrelevant. I almost said it just like that. Why did I say it like that? Because I was told to say it like that by a reviewer at the NASD. I'll tell you about that story later. Those footnotes, you need to read those, because those are where we can tell you some stories about why the numbers were put down the way they were in the financial statements. I can get by with some fun, even under the stringent conditions that are around now, with all the rules in GAAP and GAS and all the requirements of Sarbanes-Oxley and all the watchdogs at the SEC now pretending that they actually care. I can still get by with a lot, as long as I tell you in the footnotes how I did it. So those are huge. That takes me back to why I started with talking about those forms. You see, the financial statements are part of these recurrent form, the K's and Q's. You have to file them every time. Annually, they have to be audited, perfect, really nice looking, all the pieces in there and all that. But there's something else in your filings, your K's and Q's, that is actually sort of like part of this, but it's like a super version of the footnotes. It can be a monster, and it is surprisingly honest and glib sometimes, but you have to know how to read the language of it. That's why in some courses that you might take from me if you were into finance, we would just read this thing I'm going to tell you about and just read a couple of them and then talk about what the nuances of language are in it. how they stylize and convey information to the constituencies they want to convey information to, while others seeing the same thing would just pass over it. This is, in these forms, it's called the mDNA. It's, by the way, you also have one in the S1 as well. Management discussion and analysis of the results of operations. Management discussion and analysis, mDNA. That's what we used to call it, the mDNA. It can be a large, almost like a book. And in that section of the filing, you talk. The company talks to you. It doesn't matter whether you understand what it's saying or not so much, although we do have to use plain language now, which I fought tooth and nail against years ago, and I lost with others who didn't want plain language. Here's the thing. Plain language. Now, some years back, the SEC said, we've got to stop using all this legalese. We've got to use plain language to write in our filings and all that. I fought against that with some others who did this work. We said, we don't want Ma and Pa Kettle being able to read these damn financial statements. We don't want idiots being able to read these. We want to scare them off, because the last thing we want is fools thinking that they can read what we write and then go out and invest without a clue as to what it means to lose your ass on your investments. I lost. We do things plain language. But the mDNA still contains stylized wording, explanations that convey nuances, talking about, well, our operations for this year were robust in these sectors, and they are meeting our expectations in these sectors. Oh, well, that means that you sucked in this sector. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, no, well, the 8K is sort of off here to the side, but mDNA would be in a form 10K, and you will definitely see it in the initial filing for an offering. You would definitely see it. And like I said, I mean, they're grueling to read sometimes. Go ahead. It's sort of like the ginormous footnotes. Yeah, but it's not in boom, boom, boom. It's not by topic. Well, there are sections to it, but it's more like a narrative. It's more like a narrative. The footnotes are more like an exposition. Here's a point, here's a point, here's a point. The mDNA looks more like, almost like a talking to you. If you're into this kind of stuff, you actually begin to realize that there is an art to this, writing them. And also, you can't just look at these the first time and say, oh, I understand this company a lot better now, I read that mDNA. No, you have to do this for a while before you begin to get the idea of how you write in one of these, what they're saying to you. So again, what I'm doing here, and I can't emphasize this enough, is before I teach you the review of accounting, which I'm sure you're all going to sort of roll your eyes about, you've seen this, been there, done that, bite me. I'm going to make it clear to you that a really good analyst has a lot more in his inventory than just these numbers and ratios and that kind of stuff. There's a lot more to it. And many of you are actually going, whether or not you're majoring in finances, you're going to be able to do investments. The less you are completely dependent upon some salesman, and a broker is a salesman, the less you're going to be dependent upon other people to tell you, the more you have in your own inventory, you know what to do, then the less you can blame someone else when you get your ass beaten out there. And we all do. I'll give you a very specific example of this. Do any of you know who a man named Madoff is? Yeah. What? Who is he? Bernie, yeah. Oh, you call him Bernie. I don't know him on a first name.
You were in a big financial scandal pyramid scheme where you basically took other people's money and paid for a set of investors with it.
Yeah, it was a pyramid scheme. How much did it come to before it finally collapsed?
It was like 10 years or something. I don't remember.
No, the money. Just billions and billions. Story after story after story of the poor people who were screwed by this man. Bernie Madoff, the evil of the universe. He had taken money from poor old women, poor men. No. The people who knew Madoff were very wealthy. He promised them rates of return that could not be found anywhere else in the markets. They poured money into him year over year because Bernie was good for it, and he was showing them that they were making more than they could possibly have made in any other investment anywhere. You know what? Those people got exactly what they deserved. They lost their shirt because they thought they were so special that they could just rely on a man who promised them the moon. Really? 12% when everyone else in the country, all the poor slobs, were making 3%, 4%. Do you really think you're that special? These people didn't bother to read the financials. They didn't bother to think their way through. It would have been right there. I mean, I could have, some of these people, if Bernie Madoff, he didn't do it. But if I had been him, I would have said, I will bring you wronged person up on the witness stand, and I'll bring your seeing eye dog up there to testify too. See, you have a responsibility to know about investments. And once you're in my class, once you have graduated from this great school, and it is a great school, you have to know your own way. Don't blame anyone else, because I've shown you what you can do to learn your way to good investments without believing in the people who promised the moon to you just because you're better than everyone else, which is exactly what those people thought. Oh, those little people outside of New York City who don't have penthouses in Manhattan. Yeah, they don't get the good returns. We do. Bernie will make sure of it. Whatever. Mm. That's my editorial on that. Here we go. Read the MD&As. You're going to invest in companies, read MD&As. Look at the financial statements. Think your way through what you're doing. Now, let me take you on a little bit of a tour here. I'm not even going to write this part down. Revenue is what you take into a corporation. Cost is what you pay out of a corporation. Now here's, you might be sure you write this down. It's really good when your revenues are bigger than your costs. Write that down. Real finance for real people. Who says I don't give you your money's worth in here? But it might sound like a stupid thing, but at the end of the day, I talk to different people in business, and I still have a lot of contacts. I have dinners with people. And one of the things about being still in the financial analysis world is the people who, at the end of the day, they're not talking about how the numbers come together to create a profit. They're talking about, are we bringing in lots of money? Are we leaning out our costs without cutting into muscle? In other words, they're thinking about the real blood of money coming in and the real sweat of the costs going out. You see, and that's where it boils down to. In accounting, you can make a profit in a lot of ways. You know, you can make it look like profit when there's really trouble in the corporation. But at the end of the day, revenues should exceed costs. Now, the problem with revenues is that revenues can include credit sales. If all of your sales are on credit, then you are dead when you have to write a check for your bills. So, obviously, on that income statement, you're going to want to make sure that you see a nice big fat revenue line that's not associated with a big fat jump in your accounts receivable, because that means that you were making sales, but those sales were not coming in cash money. It's amazing how much more happiness you can buy with money than with a promise of money. Trust me. So I'll say that revenues with a qualification. Revenues. Now, understand that this is a simplistic distinction, but it's good enough for us for today. is I can talk about manufacturing types of companies or service types of companies. If it's a manufacturing type of company, I'm going to have a cost of goods sold in there. In other words, the stuff that went in to direct, that I can directly tie to a sale. I bought this thing for $20. I added $5 of parts to it. And I sold it for $40. I can actually trace $25 of that $40 sale to stuff, to actual physical things. That's why there's a cost of goods sold line in the financial statements that I would represent for a manufacturing company. And then we'll get down to your gross revenue. And then you're going to take out soft costs. The cost of administration, salaries, wages, electricity, and all of that. You're going to take those soft costs out. And I'm going to just put that down as expenses. But one of the things with these expenses is there is one very important line in here. And actually, some people break it off. I just do it this way. There is something that is not a cost at all that is in here as a cost. It is the depreciation. Depreciation does not exist. Depreciation does not exist. You will never write a check to someone called depreciation. You will never have someone from the side of town I used to live on come to your door and say, you owe depreciation some money. No, you can pay it now or we can hurt you. You're never going to have that happen. There is no depreciation, damn it. It doesn't exist. We put it down there because we have to spread costs out for big projects. $100 million we spent this year on this project, we are not going to be allowed to just hack $100 million off. We wouldn't want to anyway. Look what it would do to our profit, for God's sake. So we break it up. We divide it according to some schedule. Now, we can do it by different means. Do you remember in accounting the different ways you could do it, like straight line, MACRS? And then there was, do they still teach a sum of years digit thing? They do? Okay, and actually, and there were, I mean, there was almost a dizzying array of these. There was double decliners, and then there were modifies, and then there were the sum of your, we used to call it the reverse sum of your digits, but by one way or another, you break up a capital expenditure into annual pieces and that you expense off. And then you accumulate that depreciation against the capital expenditure itself on the balance sheet until you've depreciated the thing down to either zero or to a positive salvage value. One way or the other, you get down to a line called EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. Now, I'll caution. This one actually kind of hit me. I know it's popular with some companies, and some companies it's not. I just was having a nice visit with someone, a treasury officer from a corporation not far from here, and he kept talking about EBIDT, EBIT, or what, I don't even remember how he pronounced it. He just kept talking about EBIDT. That is a variation on this where you stop up here before you do the depreciation line. I'm not really interested one way or the other. I'm going to put the depreciation value back in the statement of cash flows. I'm going to add that back in to get my cash flows looking the right way. Mm. Now we start doing the fun. We take out the interest expense, and you get EBT, earnings before taxes. And then you take out your taxes, and we'll talk a little about marginal corporate tax rates and all that kind of stuff in this class, and you will get net income. Now, here's something. Net income, that's, in common parlance, that's profit. That's profit. But profit is a dirty word, so you say net income instead. Okay? It's the same thing, but usually we say net. And that we just break it down to net. We say gross, net, EBIT. We do that kind of stuff. We use those shortened terms. Part of it is very common in language, specialized language, sublanguages, dialects, is to use words so that they aren't clear to outsiders what we're talking about. We say profit. People seem to think they know what they're talking about, especially leftists and liberals. We say net, and that keeps them quiet for a while until they look it up in their dictionaries. Now, that's your net income. Net divided by revenue is net margin. Net divided by revenue is net margin. That's your first ratio. Now you can call mom and say, I know a financial ratio. Please send me $500 because I need some mom's money. In revenue divided by revenue is, I'm sorry, I said revenue here. I meant gross income. I'm sorry. Gross divided by revenue is your net gross margin. Net margin can be all over the place. Net margin can be all over the place. Some industries, as I told you, net 20%, you don't blush. In other industries, a net margin of 1% is a damn fine year. Most people seem a little, they don't believe you or me when I say in the oil industry, a net margin of, net margins are sometimes a fraction of a percent, you see. And that's just that's just the way it is. In some industries, you spend so friggin' much money on just grinding out the stuff out of the ground, through the pipes and all that, that by the time you get to the bottom line, you're making a penny on the dollar. Less than a penny sometimes. But you know what? That's okay. Let me give you one of my favorite examples. Any of you ever go to a Dollar Tree store? Have you ever, you know, one of those dollar, I go to those, as I've told you before, I'm a discount store slut. I will. You know, anything that's, if it says cheap, I'll go in there because I think they are calling me. Think about a Dollar Tree. Have you ever gone into a Dollar Tree? You don't see that many people there. Everything's a dollar. How can a store like that, how can a corporation like that function, survive, live? Well, okay, let's take a simple example. A Dollar Tree might sell 150 dollar items in one day. So they pull in 150 lousy dollars into one of those stores. And then they've got to pay for the rent for the building for the day. They've got to pay a few losers to work. I'm sorry, if you work there, it's really good employment, you know. A few fine people to work there. And they got to pay for the lights. By the time they're finished with the day, they've put maybe out of that store, they've paid out, oh, on the order of maybe $120. So that store generated only $30 at the bottom line for the day. Okay? So how could that possibly be a business model? You know what? Take that times 5,000 stores. What is that? $30 times 5,000 stores. Is that? What is that? That's $150,000 a day. Times 360 days a year, suddenly you have an 800-pound gorilla That's why stores like Aldi's are awesome. That's why as investments, long-term investments, because Aldi's and all these cheapo special stores, you spread that out, a tiny net margin on a monster chain is something to just behold. And it's part of it's because you spread over so many stores so that if even 1, 10, 50 of them don't perform for a day, a week, a year, you're not hurt because you are so spread out and that mass of revenue at the corporate top level is coming from so many different pipes. So there you are. Don't sweat it if you just see a net margin that's small. That doesn't mean a whole lot. As a matter of fact, I'm more suspicious of a company that has huge net margins than I am of a company that has small net margins. Huge net margins usually tell me that a company is in a high growth phase, which means it's highly, it's quite a bit riskier than the normal company and all that. Here's the deal. Net income isn't where we stop. Because you have to take your net income and you're going to take out your dividends. You're going to take out these dividends because those, you see, are going to the shareholders. The remaining money, your earnings, if you will, and I use this term pretty loosely right now, your earnings, that's the money you're going to plow back into the corporation. So I can take my dividends divided by my net income, and I can say that's dividends to net income. I can also then take what's left and divide it by net income. That's my plowback ratio, plowback, because that's the money that's going to go back into that corporation as a reinvestment to build that corporation. That takes us to the next very subtle, almost philosophical point. Why in the hell do corporations pay dividends? Because, you see, when you give a dividend to a shareholder, you are saying, we have nothing we can do with that money that would build capital gain on your stock. So why would corporations do this? It's a signal. We can afford to give you money and blow it. You would be surprised at how bitchy your shareholders get when you don't give them a little dividend check. And it's just the way it is. We have to say, there, here's some money. Now please shut up. Oh, we'll grow that dividend every year. See, we're so wealthy that we can give you some money year over year and not put it back into our corporation. But know this, every penny that that corporation gives to those shareholders, that shareholder earns a dividend yield. But that is also a penny that that company is not able to reinvest, which would cause the stock of that shareholder to go up. You try to explain that to shareholders, and they oftentimes look, oh, what do you mean by that? It's hard to, I want my dividend check. Where's my dividend check? Okay, fine, here, shut up, woman. That's just the way it is. We have to pay the dividends, and if a company goes way too many years without one, people get worried. Why aren't you sending the signal? Why aren't you giving us a present? If you back off a dividend, there's one that I got into. I had a company that was thinking about, they were talking about doing their first dividend. They had not, they'd been in business, I think they'd actually, it was like 7 years, and they said, we're going to do a dividend. And I was not for it. I said, you know, once you give a dividend, you can declare a special dividend. But if you just call this a dividend, you know what? People are going to expect that now. And if you don't get it to them, they're going to punish your stock. So if you put that dividend in that first time, it's like you have created a new level of commitment to your shareholders. And that's a kind of a dangerous thing. And I advised them, I said, if you're going to do this, make it a tiny dividend that you know you'll be able to afford every year. Because you're going to have ups and downs. This was a really great year. Yeah, maybe a special dividend, but don't give away the bank for God's sake. We've got projects we've got to finance. Now, understand that that money that we earn at that bottom line, those, that net income, that's very expensive money. That's very expensive money. That's internally generated equity. You see, I can sell stock to raise money. But if I want to do it the old-fashioned way, I actually make net income to raise money. So if I sell stock, that's called externally generated equity. Brings money into the corporation for investments. If I earn money at the net line, that's internally generated equity. It belongs to the shareholders, but I'm using it to make them better in the future. So it's actually that thing you see right there, that's equity. Actually, the earnings is the equity. Know this. Those dividends, see that dividend right there? And see the plowback that can happen? We call that residual. The shareholders have the residual claim on cash of the corporation. Because you have to pay the debt holders before you can pay the shareholders. You have to pay the debt holders what they are owed by contract in a timely manner. And only once you have given them what is theirs can you give the shareholders, either through dividends or through reinvestment of the residual earnings, what's theirs. That's why you'll hear me, and I will ask you this. I promise it'll be on your first exam. It'll be on your first exam. I'll ask you, what does it mean that shareholders have the residual claim on cash flows? It simply means that you have to pay the debt holders first. What is due to them when it is due? Because they are the ones. I promise you this, and I sat as the representative. One of the worst times of my life was the night I did a shareholders meeting. They stuck my ass out in front. I had no stock in the corporation. They said, he's a consultant. He'll answer the questions. The stockholders ate me alive because there was almost no money at the bottom line. We'd gotten our bills paid. So I'll tell you this, and this is the case with the shareholders. They can bitch and bitch at you. They can threaten derivative shareholder actions with those dirty law firms out in California. They can write nasty letters in papers about your corporation not giving them a dividend, the stock falling. But it is the debt holders who can shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mother wear furry costumes that please them. Wait, what? Never mind. You have to get a little older to appreciate it. Okay, now. Here. You see, though, everything comes down. That earnings there, that is actually going to contribute to the accumulation of retained earnings of the corporation. That's going to accumulate as part of the retained earnings of the corporation. So that on the balance sheet, you are going to see in the owner's equity line, retained earnings, plus net income, less dividends, is your retained earnings at the end of the period. So you see what I said before, that the income statement is just a giant nodule on the balance sheet? It really is. It's just a sidebar calculation to get to a place where you can see how much extra has been contributed in the current period to the retained earnings of the corporation. Know this, and I don't honestly know whether they teach you this in accounting or not, the retained earnings is a myth. It doesn't exist. There is no bank account that says retained earnings. I've even heard with my own ears people in the company say, well, we'll finance this project out of retained earnings. No, you won't. There is no such thing as retained earnings. This has no relationship to what is in that corporation whatsoever. Retained earnings is just sort of like a running tab of how much year-to-year earnings have been put in, have been generated by accounting rules in the company. Doesn't have any relationship whatsoever to the reality of the company's ability to pay its bills, to generate money for new investments, to bring revenue in, and all those good things. Doesn't have any relationship. And if I look at other parts of the balance sheet above this, this is part of owner's equity. You see that retained earnings at the end? That is just a theoretical kind of representation of part of the owner's position in the corporation. You add to that the common stock of the corporation, how much they sold their stock at. That is part of the what the owner's equity is in a financial statement. Now, know this. There are actually two parts to the common stock. Like if I sell 100 shares of common stock at $5 each, the common stock line would say $500 there. Historically, there's been this, and this goes back hundreds of years, common stock is usually authorized in those articles of incorporation I told you about. It's authorized at a par value. That's a real small number, sometimes a penny, sometimes a hundredth of a penny. Now, historically, that represented sort of like a liability of the shareholders to the corporation. It really hasn't much meaning, but by accounting standards, you have to break it off. So I would say you would see actually common stock at par, and then common stock in excess of par. You would see it broken into two lines. Now, they don't call it in excess of par, but that's what I'm going to call it here. Look, suppose that you had sold 500 shares ABC common par 0.01 dollar per share common. By the way, historically, it's not done very much anymore. Historically, the word common, like preferred, would be capitalized. It was actually a proper noun. You might see me revert to the old system because we still capitalize common in the old days. Anymore, they don't really do it too much, but it was technically, it was a part of the entity. The common stock actually was a legal entity. It was a sign of the existence of the corporation. So we capitalize as a proper noun because the corporation was a proper noun. But that's not okay. So the way I would put it here would be, I'd say, well, that would mean that $5 of that 500, sold at $2 per share, we would have $1,000 come into the corporation. But 0.01 times 500 would be, what the hell is 0.01 times 500? Don't get old like this. Kill yourself before you get to my age. Oh, would someone tell me what? Oh, okay, $5. $5 would be the par recognition, and then the remainder of it, $995, would be the amount in excess of par for the $1,000. So you'll see it broken up like that. For our purposes, just when you're doing financial analysis with ratios and all that, just put the numbers together. But like I said, historically, they would actually bust up the value of money that came into a corporation into the two parts, the par value and then the rest. The par value representing sort of like a liability of the shareholders. It was weird. Now, one of the things, I was not comfortable with it, but there were several companies that actually, it's very more popular now, to authorize the stock with par value zero, no par value. And it's apparently allowed, and there were companies that wanted me to do it that way. It just kind of weirded me because we'd always done it with some par value. Sometimes it's like a thousandth of a dollar per share. But anyway, what were they? But know this. See these two numbers? Or put them together. That's really not too relevant either in any usable sense. Because this company might have sold that stock 20 years ago. So those numbers there representing the common stock, they are historical numbers that are really not very much related to the company itself. Now, so if I put together these two numbers and your retained earnings at the end of the period, that is what we call the book value of the equity. The book value of the equity. It's book value. And I will tell you right now, you will hear, it just amazes me, these analysts on television and radio, especially on television, all the time, well, book to market is really attractive. What they're talking about is taking the book value of the stock divided by the market value of the stock. Book to market. And that's supposed to be some kind of a signal of a buy or a sell. You know what? It is nothing. It means nothing because those are historical numbers. There's not even such a thing as a retained earnings account. The common stock numbers could have been there from, it's sort of built up from stock sales year from 1 year to the next. No meaning to it. So any ratio that's based upon a book on book doesn't tell you a damn thing about that corporation. It just can't because it's old news. Now before I get to the last part here, I'm going to tell you a little bit of a thought. It's a thought experiment. And it leads to something called the efficient market hypothesis. Now, I warn you, the word hypothesis is used by those who simply refuse to believe it. And they refuse to believe it because they have money that they can make off suckers who don't have any idea that something like this exists. Let me start with a story, with an idea. You, sir, you look like a studious young man. Clean white t-shirt, combed back hair, good looking. Well, handsome young stud, Presbyterian, I would imagine. You do your research every day, and you go over to Milner Library. You go up into the stacks, and you read. You're one of those kind of studious people. You finally go way up into the stacks at the library, and you find that they have left all these old business newspapers, I mean dusty, yellowing, crumbling, lying on the floor. You pick one up and you read it, and you notice that here's an interesting story. There's this company that is working on this electronic device. And this is an awesome thing. It has the ability to compute mathematical things. The possibilities are endless, just endless with this. But of course, it hasn't come out yet, but this company is doing some very serious research. And there's discussions, there's rumors that they've got a secret government contract. And this is a reputable paper, so you know that might actually be the case. Now, this device, you notice that the newspaper is dated in the 1930s. This device is something they're calling a computing machine, computer for short. And this company is called IBM. Well, you're right now here in September 12th, 2011. Are you going to call your broker and say, I need to buy IBM now? I just got some hot information. Why not? Old? Well, so
I'm old. I'm still great, for God's sake. If you want to pass this course, you'll say, yeah, teacher. They're not that old, okay? So stop it. Now look. You're right, though. It's old information. Well, what happens if you had read it in a newspaper last week? Would you call your broker today? No. You know what? I can show you places on Wall Street that react to information that hasn't even happened yet. They are looking 2-3 microseconds into the future now. It's called high-frequency trading. You see, you can't beat a market because the market has already taken all historical information and it's already in the price. All that's going to matter is what happens tomorrow. We'll pick this back up on Wednesday. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.